HPPodcraft.com.
He stood a moment on the steps of the bank, watching the human river that swirled down Broadway. Few noticed him. Few ever noticed him, save in a way that stung. He was outside the world, nothing, as he said bitterly. Bits of the words of the walkers came to him. The comet? The comet. Everybody was talking of it. Even the president, as he entered, smiled patronizingly at him and asked, "Well, Jim, are you scared?" "No," said the messenger shortly. "I thought we journeyed through the comet's tail once," broke in the junior clerk affably.
"Oh, that was Halley's," said the president. "This is a new comet, quite a stranger, they say. Wonderful, wonderful. I saw it last night. Oh, by the way, Jim," turning again to the messenger, "I want you to go down into the lower vaults today."
That was the opening of the W.E.B. Du Bois story called The Comet.
This story was written in 1920, a year Lovecraft himself was writing. And we thought, since Du Bois was a contemporary of Lovecraft and a black author, that it would be good to cover this story on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at hppodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
So this isn't really a weird tale, necessarily, but it does have elements that are crucial to Lovecraft's work, such as a fear of racial mixing, which was present in a lot of his work. It also, there are some appeals to ancient history or rather people suddenly feeling these deep ancestral connections, which comes up in a lot of his work. The comet itself, Lovecraft mentioned comets quite a bit in his work and loved his astronomy, so there are some things that are related. Also, in one of Lovecraft's very few straight-up science fiction stories, In the Walls of Eryx, we covered that near the end of doing his work.
Right, we did.
That was a story that he co-wrote with Kenneth J. Sterling. We get this in the beginning of that story. "By noon it was drier, but even then I could not make much speed. These Carter oxygen masks are too heavy. Just carrying one half wears an ordinary man out. A Du Bois mask with sponge reservoir instead of tubes would give just as good air at half the weight." Hey, so maybe that was a reference to W.E.B. Du Bois.
Could be.
Who knows?
Could be.
If you search Du Bois Lovecraft, that's the only thing that comes up is what I'm saying.
I see. Gotcha.
Hey, one thing we do know, though, is that we have an excellent reader today.
Andrew Lehman!
Thank you, Lehman, for jumping in on this one and for coming back to lend us your sultry voice.
Let's talk about W.E.B. Du Bois. And it is pronounced Du Bois, not Du Bois, which I almost insisted on it pronouncing in that way. But he said in a letter written in 1939 that the pronunciation of my name is Du Bois, with the accent on the last syllable.
Right.
William Edward Burghardt Du Bois was born February 23rd, 1868 in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He was from a family of free blacks who owned land in the area. His dad left when he was 2 years old and his mother moved back with her family in Great Barrington. Great Barrington was a European American city, so he was treated well for the time and had white friends that he played with. He wrote about the stigma of having no father, which seemed to be a social problem to him almost as much as being a minority. He attended public school and his teacher saw his talent and encouraged him. His church helped raise money for him to go to college. He went to school at Fisk University in Tennessee, which was a black school where he first experienced Southern racism, which at the time encompassed Jim Crow laws, bigotry, suppression of black voting, and lynchings.
Yeah.
After Fisk, he went to Harvard, and in 1895, he was the first African-American to earn a PhD from Harvard University. He went on to teach, and then he went into sociological research. He wrote his landmark paper, The Philadelphia Negro, a Social Study, in 1899, which kicked off his writing career. While working as a professor at Atlanta University, W.E.B. Du Bois rose to national prominence when he very publicly opposed Booker T. Washington's Atlanta Compromise, an agreement that asserted that vocational education for blacks was more valuable to them than social advantages like higher education or political office. Du Bois criticized Washington for not demanding equality for African Americans as granted by the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, that was a big divide between those two African American leaders, because the compromise basically accepted segregation in return for some educational opportunities that would be mostly financed by the North. We actually talked about this when we covered of One Blood, remember, because there were the minstrels in there. A lot of these educational opportunities were in music or the arts, or as you said, vocational, which is great, but science, math, these things, not so much. Didn't get that kind of funding. Du Bois didn't want to compromise for so little, you know, he wanted true equal rights, or at least better opportunities that were being offered under the Atlanta Compromise.
In 1903, Du Bois published his seminal work, The Souls of Black Folk, a collection of 14 essays. In the years that followed, he adamantly opposed the idea of biological white superiority and vocally supported women's rights. In 1909, he co-founded the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and served as editor of its magazine, The Crisis.
The NAACP.
Did not know that he did that.
Well, science fiction writing was something that was a little bit of a hobby for him.
Yeah.
That's not primarily what he's known for.
Nope.
But The Comet, which is a science fiction story, was included as the 10th chapter of his book Darkwater, Voices from Within the Veil, which was published in 1920. It incorporates autobiographical information as well as essays, spirituals, and poems all written by Du Bois. Some of the awful things that he witnessed prior to this book, I think, inform its apocalyptic tone. Hmm. And a lot of the horror that's in it, because there are aspects of at least the horror of death.
Sure.
Obviously, post-slavery black life was difficult, but it was also punctuated by tremendous violence. Yeah. In one of his autobiographies, Du Bois talks about Sam Hose, who was a black worker who was tortured and lynched by a mob. He had killed his boss in self-defense. After he was lynched and killed, his body parts were sold off, and Du Bois recalls seeing Hose's knuckles on display in the window of an Atlanta butcher shop, which really shook him up, obviously. He wrote, "Something died in me that day." Worse, and I think closer to what's going on in the story, were the Atlanta race riots, which took place over 2 days, and that's directly related to this Atlanta Compromise. Yeah. You have to understand that there were these massive shifts in culture after the Civil War. In 1880, there was an African-American population in Atlanta of about 9,000, and by 1900, it was 35,000 because of the railway job opportunities. So you had the kind of paranoia that we see even going on in the world now, because there's just a huge influx of changing population in that part of the country. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that employers could pit white workers against black workers for jobs, because now that they were free, they were competing for the same jobs, the same wages. Mm-hmm. And blacks were actually starting to do fairly well, opening up businesses, and they had voting rights. In 1906, some local newspapers reported a string of incidents involving black men assaulting white women. None of these incidents were ever proven.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think this was all in a large part caused by a political race. There were two Democrats duking it out to be candidate for governor. Right. Both had affiliations with major newspapers, and both were worried that the black vote would sway the election for the other guy. So they wanted to suppress it as much as possible. And they spent a good deal of time over time demonizing the black population in those newspapers,
yeah.
You know, saying their taverns were hubs of vice, that they were, you know, animalistic and rapists. And with these newest reports that these white women had been assaulted, that was the last straw. 10,000 white men rampaged through Atlanta, beating every black person they could find. It resulted in over 25 deaths, and I think of black men, I think men and women, and I think two white men died. Le Petit Journal reported, "Black men and women were thrown from trolley cars, assaulted with clubs, and pelted with stones. An unknown and disputed number of blacks were killed and many injured. The governor called in the militia to restore order." And after this, you know, more folks pushed for segregation as an answer, because they said it was the intermingling of the races that caused all of this. They blamed the victims. And Du Bois wrote this essay, A Litany in Atlanta, which asserted that that riot demonstrated that the Atlanta Compromise was a failure.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many more incidents like this that Du Bois witnessed in his lifetime. During those Atlanta riots, he lived there. He was actually in front of his house with a shotgun ready to defend his property. So he lived through a lot of these things as well.
Wow.
So obviously there's a lot more to discuss on this issue, and especially in his biography. I mean, when you last left, I think, what did you say, in 1903, he published Souls of Black Folk, and then, you know, he didn't die until
63,
and a lot happened in between. You know, he had some interesting involvement in the world wars and the Harlem Renaissance, but
yeah.
We need to focus on that little known fact that he liked to write science fiction as well. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time.
The guy had an amazing life, and he went through a lot of stuff. Obviously can't do him justice on this show. Mm-hmm. He died August 27th, 1963. He was 95 mm-hmm. years old.
Nice.
He was in Ghana while working on a book. That was the day before Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington.
Wow.
So we got to see some of the start of the civil rights movement.
Well, an influential guy.
Yeah, I can't stress how influential and important he was as a figure.
But let's get into the story.
It starts off with the anticipation of a comet coming close to Earth, and Earth will be going through the comet's tail. Everybody thinks it'll be cool.
Yep.
First thing I thought was Night of the Comet.
Mm-hmm.
Did they crib this from Du Bois?
That 80s movie, right? It's possible.
Yeah.
You know, I've only seen that one like a long time ago on cable, but the comet in there kills everybody but some teenagers, right? Something
well, yeah.
Like that.
Well, it's kind of similar where they there's some kind of weird radiation, and if you're surrounded by a certain kind of metal, that you're not affected. And so the girl and her sister were like in some vault.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then they come out, but everybody's like vaporized. They're not just corpses. They're piles of dust. And then there's people that got a little bit of exposure. Then they become, they're like mutants. And then they go around trying to kill people.
Oh, right, right, right. That's right. I just remember them holed up in a dance club or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, comets have a long, long tradition in literature as the outright cause of doom, but sometimes just as signs or portents of doom.
Sure.
I think this story might have definitely influenced Night of the Comet, but there were some things that might have influenced this, such as Poe's The Conversation of Eros and Carmion from 1839, which is an end-of-the-world story involving a comet that steals the nitrogen from Earth's atmosphere. The remaining oxygen is what causes our fiery end.
Oof.
Camille Flammarion's La Fin du Monde, The End of the World, from 1894, describes a 24th century collision of a comet with Earth. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's Deep Impact, with which Du Bois would have seen, starring Taya Leone. In that second Game of Thrones book, there's a cool thing because there's a comet that's shooting across the sky in that book.
Oh.
They did it in the show, too. But everybody's seeing it in every part of Westeros, and they're all interpreting what it means one way or another. Comets are always used that way in literature, so they've been around for a long time.
As we heard at the top, our protagonist, Jim, is called the Messenger. I'm assuming that he's a messenger for this bank. Is that what he's working for, a bank?
Yeah, I think so. They said in that first paragraph he's standing outside the bank.
Is asked by his boss to go down to the sub-vaults of the business and look for some old files. And there was some water damage, so the place is all gross.
At first, I thought this might be actually the president of the United States.
Yeah, me too. I did.
Yeah. But then I realized that it's a business. And I think the fact that Jim is a messenger is his job, but it also gives this story kind of a Shakespearean feel, you know?
Yeah.
It's always the messenger at the beginning who kind of lays out the current state of the world. And it's also got some biblical implications, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
But Jim, in the normal, you know, even in this normal world before it's disrupted by the comet, is very conscious of his low status, and he is displeased with it.
Yeah.
You know, he says, of course, they wanted him to go down into the vault. And even in that opening that we heard, the third sentence of the story is, few ever noticed him, save in a way that stung, which is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And although the protagonist is kind of chafing under the oppression that he faces, there's still this vulnerability about him. And that lasts throughout the story, which I think really pushes the story past a simple moralistic tale. It does invite you to look at the humanity of the characters. And for 1920, I think that that's probably what people really needed to be reading.
When he gets down there, the place is a mess. It's disgusting with fetid water and rats. But while down there, he finds a secret vault that he didn't even know was down there. And he pushes into it and finds the files that he's looking for. And he also finds this old chest. He's curious to what's in the chest because it's all falling apart and rotted. But so he pries it open and it's got gold in there, ton of gold. As he opens up that chest, the vault door closes.
Yeah, he suddenly is terrified that he's going to be locked in this vault forever, as would anybody.
So he messes with the door, pushing and prodding until he finds this cool bit of metal and the door opens.
Yeah.
There's a strange smell that comes in from the room next door. And then he sees on the floor the vault clerk that was there. That let him in dead.
That vault clerk, you know, not that much time has passed. He went down, he was maybe in there an hour or something fishing around.
Yeah.
And this comet passed through and killed everybody. So I think that vault clerk must have pooped his pants. Like, he wouldn't be rotting yet. I'm just trying to explain the strange smell.
So he hurries up and calls for the guards, but there's no answer. He goes up and sees that they are dead as well.
Yeah.
Jim thinks, oh no, it's been a robbery and a murder. But he gets up, everyone in the building is dead, so he runs out onto Wall Street.
Even worse than there's been a robbery and murder, he thinks, if they found him here alone, with all this money and all these dead men, what would his life be worth?
Yeah, they would think he did it.
If it was you or I, we'd think, oh boy, I better go get the police, there's been some kind of crime. But he thinks, I gotta get the out of here because they're gonna blame it on me, you know?
Right. He opens the door and the street is totally quiet and everybody is dead. And something horrible has happened. All of these scenes of chaos and death, whatever's happened, didn't happen all at once. He says, in the great stone doorway, 100 men and women and children lay crushed and twisted and jammed, forced into a great gaping doorway like refuse in a can. As if one wild, frantic rush to safety, they all had rushed and ground themselves to death.
So there was some kind of massive panic once people realized what was happening.
Looking around, we see a newspaper in a dead newspaper boy's hands, and it says, danger, warnings wired around the world, comet's tail sweeps past at noon, deadly gases expected, closed doors and windows seek the cellar.
Which is where, you know, he inadvertently was sent because of his low status, but that's what saved his life. You know, I get tired of the speed of news on the internet and all that, but we do have it a little better than 1920. I mean, here they've all just died and they're only getting the paper right then. Hey, don't breathe. But of course, Jim is wondering, you know, is everybody dead? Is it possible that they killed everybody? So he's going to go find out.
And this is your kind of typical post-apocalyptic driving around looking for survivors sort of thing. Mm-hmm. He's looking all over New York City trying to find anybody. He goes up to Fifth Avenue into the fancy restaurants and he eats some food that he finds there. And he thinks, yesterday, they would not have served me.
Yeah, and that's an interesting moment that's almost a trope. Like you say, we've seen so many of these post-apocalyptic movies now, mostly zombie movies. And there's that scene where, now that everybody's gone, you can have whatever you want.
Right.
Right. Like Dawn of the Dead or 28 Days Later, you think, I'm going to eat all the candy I want. I'm going to take a dump in this showroom toilet. Nobody can stop me, you know.
Right.
But for this character in this story, it's so much more meaningful because it's not just exercising greed. It's actually toppling the order of society now that society's disappeared. It's access that he never would have had to begin with.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm the only one alive in 1920, I might jump in a sweet car that I otherwise couldn't afford. Mm-hmm. But given the resources, it would still be sold to me.
Right.
For this character, he wouldn't even be allowed near the showroom. It's a much more politically significant moment than we usually see in these types of stories.
He gets a car from some dead people, and he drives around looking for anybody. Some very beautifully horrible descriptions of the dead.
Yeah, somewhat realistic, and he's certainly not afraid to point out the babies and the children that are lying around as well.
As he's driving around, he hears a woman screaming for help from a window.
He wheeled the car in a sudden circle, running over the still body of a child and leaping on the curb. Then he rushed up the steps and tried the door and rang violently. There was a long pause, but at last the heavy door swung back. They stared a moment in silence. She had not noticed before that he was a Negro. He had not thought of her as white. She was a woman of perhaps 25, rarely beautiful and richly gowned, with darkly golden hair and jewels. Yesterday, he thought with bitterness, she would scarcely have looked at him twice. He would have been dirt beneath her silken feet. She stared at him. Of all the sorts of men she had pictured as coming to her rescue, she had not dreamed of one like him. Not that he was not human, but he dwelt in a world so far from her, so infinitely far, that he seldom even entered her thought. Yet as she looked at him curiously, he seemed quite commonplace and usual. He was a tall, dark working man of the better class, with a sensitive face trained to stolidity and a poor man's clothes and hands. His face was soft and slow, and his manner at once cold and nervous, like fires long banked but not out. So a moment each paused and gauged the other. Then the thought of the dead world without rushed in, and they started toward each other.
They rush together, you know, what's happened? Tell me, she's confused, right? Because she's just been locked up in the tower.
He tells her it seems like everybody's dead. He hasn't seen a living person except for her since the whole thing happened. She says that her father left for work at the Metropolitan Tower that morning, and Jim tells her to leave a note, and then they're going to go there and check it out.
And this girl is wealthy. Also, talking about those zombie movies, this isn't entirely dissimilar to the one that started them all, right? Romero's Night of the Living Dead, which was definitely taking on civil rights theme in the era that it was made, but in which our first two characters are a white woman and a black man who comes in to help her.
He starts to go and then stops. And then he says to her, I have to go to Harlem first. And she looks at him and says, Harlem? And then she sees the look on his face and then understands. They go to take the car that he borrowed, and then she says she's got a faster one. They drive into his neighborhood, and he jumps out of the car, runs into a building. In a bit, he comes out, and he's gray-faced, and she asks, have you lost somebody? And he says, I've lost everybody. He also has something in his hand, something film-like, which he stuffs in his pocket. He apologizes for being selfish, and they go to the Metropolitan Tower. They move the dead elevator operator out of the way, and then they go up. They find her father's office is there with a note on the desk. It says, Dear daughter, I've gone for a 100-mile spin in Fred's new Mercedes. Shall not be back before dinner. I'll bring Fred with me. GBH. She says they have to search the city. And when they do, they only find death. Towards the end of the day, the bodies are beginning to smell. And she's out of ideas, and Jim takes the lead. The long-distance telephone, the telegraph and the cable, night rockets, and then flight.
That's the plan. That's the order in which he thinks they should reach out. First, we'll try the phone, then the telegraph, the cable. We'll fire off some rockets, and if all that doesn't work, they're going to figure out how to, I don't know, take a plane or something like that.
Him taking charge, it kind of changes her perspective on him. She says, she looked at him now with strength and confidence. He did not look like men as she had always pictured men, but he acted like one, and she was content.
And her coming around to him, I think, demonstrates how paper thin these societal rules are. It happens relatively fast.
Yeah.
I mean, once the society is gone, this guy's just human. But before they go into the phone company, this happens. It says, as they came to the door, he stepped quickly before her and pressed her gently back as he closed it. She heard him moving to and fro and knew his burdens. Poor little burdens he bore. When she entered, he was alone in the room. So he's gone in there and essentially cleaned it up for her, so she doesn't have to deal with all the bodies he knows are gonna be in there.
Right.
Even though they've seen death all day, he's still trying, and this is way different from the savage black man that she's probably always heard about in the newspapers, because she never would have had access to their lives, as she said.
They get to the phone company central switchboard and start calling everywhere, hoping to find a living person, and they don't. She starts to freak out. She turned toward the door with a new fear in her heart. For the first time, she seemed to realize that she was alone in the world with a stranger, with something more than a stranger, with a man alien in blood and culture, unknown perhaps, unknowable. It was awful. She must escape. And she just takes off. She runs away, leaves the building. And as she's running, she realizes, you know, what the hell is she doing? Where's she going to run to? Where's she going to go? And so she just stands there and cries. And then Jim comes out, and he's very quiet, understanding. She walks to him, and then they go to the car. He helps her in, and then she says, "Not that." And he answers slowly, "No, not that." What is that about?
I wasn't entirely sure either. I mean, I think in that scene, right before that, when she runs out, he's well aware that she's about to leave him.
Yeah.
And he stands at the top of the alleyway and doesn't actually give chase or anything like
that.
No. Because I think he just knows, well, this might happen at any time. He's used to that sort of thing. When she comes back to him, then he goes to her. So perhaps it's them saying, like, no, not that. We're not going to turn on each other. We're not going to leave each other alone in this world.
Right, right.
Could be what they're referring to. Or it's an admission that, you know, we're together now. We're committing to each other. But even though you're touching me to put me in the car, that's as physical as it's going to get, okay?
Yeah.
Which I think is probably more likely. I mean, that's the vibe I got. Yes, we're together, but no, not that.
It says here, they flew towards the cable office on the east side, leaving the world of wealth and prosperity for the world of poverty and work. In the world behind them were death and silence, grave and grim, almost cynical, but always decent. Here it was hideous. It clothed itself in every ghastly form of terror, struggle, hate, and suffering. It lay wreathed in crime and squalor, greed and lust. Only in its dread and awful silence was it like death everywhere. Going to this kind of poor neighborhood, when things started going bad, people went nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he says there's a peace in the horror, kind of a quiet reverence. And they look at each other for a second in the eyes, and they're both feeling the same thing, and they have a connection.
They have this moment after that, though, where they're—I believe they're up on a bridge of some kind. They're telegraphing for help.
Yeah.
But they're looking down in the cold and luring waters, as they're called. And he kind of steps toward them. You know, he's lost everything, and he's contemplating suicide.
Yeah.
He says, "The world lies beneath the waters now. May I go?" And then she looks at him, feels pity, and says, "No." But also they're relaxing into each other a bit. They've been together all day. She says she forgot to wonder at the quickness with which he had learned to drive her car. It seemed natural. So it's already he's already a part of her world.
They go back to her father's office. She writes a note and they go to the roof. Jim wraps her in a shawl and she smiles. And he's very tender and he's kind with her. And they talk a bit. She's been idly rich her whole life and he's worked really hard just to stay poor.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "How foolish our human distinctions seem now, looking down at the great dead city stretch below, swimming in unlightened shadows." "Yes, I was not human yesterday," he said. "And your people were not my people," she said. "But today, death, the leveler," he muttered.
"And the revealer," she whispered gently, rising to her feet with great eyes. He turned away and, after fumbling a moment, sent a rocket into the darkening air. I think the scene's really pretty that they're having this moment together on top of this building in New York City, firing rockets off into the sky. Yeah.
At that moment, race and status fade away. She is a woman, he is a man, and they are both the only thing that each other has.
It's an Adam and Eve story in that respect. And there's biblical imagery. It says she looked upon the man beside her and forgot all else but his manhood, his strong, vigorous manhood, his sorrow and sacrifice. She saw him glorified. He was no longer a thing apart, a creature below, a strange outcast of another clime and blood, but her brother humanity incarnate, son of God and great all-father of the race to be. All right, they're starting to feel like, okay, we got a job to do here.
But Jim, you know, he feels something that he hasn't felt before. He feels freedom. You know, he's free of all of the oppression that has troubled him his whole life. The world is now his and hers. He looks to her and sees that she is looking at him. And it says, "Their souls lay naked to the night. It was not lust. It was not love. It was some vaster, mightier thing that needed neither touch of body nor thrill of soul. It was a thought divine, splendid." And they say to each other almost together, "The world is dead," and then "Long live." And then right as they're about to say it, they hear a car horn honking in the distance.
Yeah, I think they're about to say long live the world, right?
Like, yeah.
Meaning that we're going to continue it. And then there's a hoarse and sharp, it says hoarse and sharp, the cry of a motor drifted clearly up from the science below. So it's just a huge buzzkill, too. It's not even just that they get interrupted. It's this, you know.
Yeah, some kind of firework is shot off again. Then they hear the elevator motor running. The door opens, filled with men. The one older man sees Julia, the female protagonist of the story, and he says, "My daughter." Mm-hmm. Another younger man moves to Julia and says, "Julia, my darling, I thought you were gone forever." He seems to be her beau. She asks if the world is gone. And Fred, the guy, he says, "Only New York. Is terrible, awful. But you, how did you escape? How did you endure the horror? Are you well, unharmed?" And they finally notice that Jim's standing there, and they get all like they're going to beat him down because he was with Julia. But she stops them and says that he saved her. And her dad reaches in his pocket, gives him a wad of cash.
So demeaning. And after all you've been through with them, you really feel that when he peels off the wad of cash and just stuffs it into his hand.
You do. Her father asks him his name, and he says it's Jim Davis. Then her dad says,
"Well, Jim, thank you. I've always liked your people. If you ever want a job, call on me." And they were gone. The crowd poured up and out of the elevators, talking and whispering. Who was it? Are they alive? How many? Two. Who was saved? A white girl and a nigger. There she goes. A nigger? Where is he? Let's lynch the damned. Shut up. He's all right. He saved her. Saved hell. He had no business. Here he comes. Into the glare of the electric lights, the colored man moved slowly, with the eyes of those that walk and sleep. "Well, what do you think of that?" cried a bystander. "Of all New York, just a white girl and a nigger." The colored man heard nothing. He stood silently beneath the glare of the light, gazing at the money in his hand and shrinking as he gazed. Slowly, he put his other hand into his pocket and brought out a baby's filmy cap and gazed again. A woman mounted to the platform and looked about, shading her eyes. She was brown, small, and toil-worn, and in one arm lay the corpse of a dark baby. The crowd parted and her eyes fell on the colored man. With a cry, she tottered toward him. "Jim!" He whirled, and with a sob of joy, caught her in his arms.
That's the end of the story.
So that thing that he'd taken from Harlem was this hat.
Yeah.
That at least his wife managed to find him.
I assume that was his wife, and she was with their child who had died.
That's a pretty rough way to end it.
Yeah, this is a heavy tale.
Yeah, it's a heavy story, but it's a heavy story about a heavy topic, you know? I think it's appropriately heavy.
Yeah.
And much like Night of the Living Dead, you know, things don't work out well for the black man in the end.
No. There's a lot of religious overtones, like you were saying at the beginning of the story, the fact that he's called the messenger.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the messenger in Christianity is often referred to as an angel, like Gabriel, who relays God's messages to the Virgin Mary.
Yeah.
That she would bear Christ. Like in this story, Jim and Julia, maybe they're like Adam and Eve figures and they're going to start a new world.
Yeah, she calls him the all-father of the race to be, also the son of God, so like he's a Christ figure.
Yeah, so there's a lot of a mixing of Old Testament, New Testament metaphors in here. This story is often accredited as being one of the first stories of the Afrofuturism movement. It's a movement in literature, music, and art featuring futuristic or science fiction themes which incorporate elements of Black history and culture. And I think this story in particular represents that is because it would be the beginning of a new civilization that is started by a black man and a white woman, but that black man's culture and his ideas will be part of that new civilization.
I also think that that tradition of writing is putting emphasis on the fact that it wasn't always this way as well. You know, we have to look to the past, that black civilizations have been great. The things that have been passed down to all of civilization came from those earlier black civilizations that were, you know, I think of One Blood was pointing to that quite a bit as well.
Right.
This story fits into something that's a tradition, though, in all of literature, which is really that idea of star-crossed lovers, the idea that society is going to keep two people apart for tribal reasons.
Right.
So in that respect, it's just like Romeo and Juliet or anything like that, where you've got, you know, two folks who society has said can't be together. Once they're outside the bounds of that society, they find, hey, we have a lot more in common than we actually thought we did. You are not a monster, as you were told to me. And I'm not a monster, as was described to you. And so I think that's an old story.
Yeah.
But when applied to things that were happening at the time, you know, in 1920, this is the frankness of the tone actually surprises me a little bit.
Yeah.
And the frankness with which he discusses his displeasure with the way things are going, I think, is honest and open. And I wonder if it was received well outside of African-American readership. I'm not sure. I could imagine it ruffling some feathers.
But, yes, absolutely.
It did have a, you know, real impact on me, thinking, well, yeah, I mean, society could break down at any moment. And what are the, and there are so many artificial barriers we put between ourselves.
Sure.
That fall away when circumstances demand it. So anyway, I think it's a good science fiction story. It's a lot to digest. And I'm not kidding when I think that it's a good companion piece to a lot of the Lovecraftian stories that we've read, because they deal with a lot of these same issues in different ways.
Yeah.
Much like, and I felt the same way about Of One Blood. I mean, the idea of races mixing is all over Shadow over Innsmouth and all those kinds of stories, and Arthur German and Medusa's Coil. And so it's very germane to the study of what we do here. For those who think we're veering away from those themes, I don't think we are at all.
No.
But what are we going to do next week?
We're going to jump back to Octavia Butler.
Okay.
Everybody seemed to really dig our coverage of it, and I enjoyed the story quite a bit. I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
There's another of hers that folks have recommended to us called Speech Sounds.
Okay.
So we're going to check that one out.
Speech Sounds by Octavia Butler. I really liked the last story, so I'm looking forward to that. We also, believe it or not, are having some problem finding older weird fiction or science fiction stories by African-American authors. So folks, if you can recommend any that we haven't covered yet, please email, Facebook, Twitter, whatever is at your disposal, and let us know about those stories. Yeah. Because we've got more that we want to cover, but it's difficult to find them. They always bring great revelations with them, so we want more. I want to thank Andrew Lehman for being a reader this week.
Thank you so much, Andrew. You did an outstanding job, as always.
As always. We'll be back with more Octavia Butler next week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.